This is talking with Jim Roberts on 28th February 78 at Radiophysics in Sydney. So the first paper I have here that you wrote connected with radio astronomy was in Phys Rev in 1949. Can you tell me how, first of all, what your educational background was and then how you got involved in radio astronomy?
Well, I did a degree at Sydney University.
In what field?
Well, I started doing engineering, and at Sydney you could do 2 years engineering and swap over and do 1 year and complete a science degree, which is what I did. Mm-hmm. But I never went back and finished my engineering. I then did a fourth year, I guess, to get an honours degree, and then another 18 months, something like that, for a Master of Science.
This would be in physics now?
In physics. Mm-hmm. And the head of the department was Victor Bailey, who was really a pure mathematician, masquerading as the professor of experimental physics. And he was tremendously interested in what was known as electricity and gases in those days, propagation waves in plasmas.
He published a couple of papers, didn't he, on solar atmosphere?
Well,
maybe a bit
later on he did. He developed, at this time, he developed this thing which he called the electromagneto-ionic theory. And the way it differed from the magneto-ionic theory was that he had an electric field present in the plasma. So it was a source of power and you get amplified waves, and sure enough he got amplified waves. Mm-hmm. And that was how the Division of Radio Physics got interested, because he was putting as forth as possibly the way the solar burst is, the excess radiation from the sun. And so that was what I was working on for my master's degree.
I see. So this paper then in Phys Rev came out of working with him?
Yes. There are actually some papers with him too in the Australian Journal of Science. The paper in Phys Rev was actually shown to be wrong. Like Pierce from Bell Lab.
What were you trying to get at? What were you trying to explain in that paper?
It seemed from Bailey's theory that even if you just had a stream of electrons moving, you could get what were called growing waves in those days, wave amplification. It turned out that he'd included some terms of the order of V over C squared and not some others, and if you put them all in and you really thought about the boundary conditions, it didn't work. But it was a sticky subject, and it's still a sticky subject. I don't think people really know the answer yet.
Well, as I mentioned to you before, there's now a 5-year gap before your next publication in Radio Astronomy anyway. Can you tell me what was happening then?
As I was saying, there were no PhDs given at Sydney in those days. I doubt if there was any Australian university to get PhDs. And so people who wanted to get a PhD had to find some means of getting overseas. And I happened to be at the lucky time just after the war when there were a lot of scholarships. I think everybody in our year that did the MSc got scholarships and went overseas. CSIRO just started giving their scholarships. There were National University just been founded and they were giving scholarships. Mm-hmm. Woomera Rocket Range had just been founded and they were giving scholarships. So I think we all went overseas. And I went to Cambridge. After some shenanigans, I ended up with Hoyle as my supervisor.
I see.
And
was your original intention to work in Ratcliffe's group?
I didn't really have an original intention. I was very naive. I didn't know, you know, people over there or what they worked in. I wasn't particularly interested in astronomy.
Oh, I see.
I mean, my real interest, which probably comes from the time of Bailey and before, is in how radiation is produced, and to some extent the propagation afterwards, but it's the mechanism by which the stuff's produced that's the interesting thing.
And so how did you end up at Hoyle?
Well, I guess it was Briggs, who was the head of the National Physical Laboratory at that stage. National Standards Lab here in Sydney, what's now the National Measurements Lab, part of CSIRO, who knew something about Hoyle's work he was, you know, making noises at this stage, and thought he'd be an exciting fellow to work with. And so I actually finally arranged that I went and worked with him.
Mm-hmm.
I had been negotiating with Ratcliffe to go to Cavendish, and Ratcliffe actually gave me a place to sit in the Napier Shaw Library, I think it was, in Cavendish.
To the foot in the door.
You make me remember my arrival at the Cavendish and going down there, and Ratcliffe's secretary telling me that, you know, I had really put my foot in it. People do not accept a position in the Cavendish and then turn it down.
I see.
However, we got over all that.
But was Hoyle interested in radiation processes?
Yes. He had very wide interest, but he was very interested in how the radiation was originating, in these, particularly in the sun. And the thing that he got me working on was the idea he had for solar radiation for, well, I'm not sure what type it was, I'm not sure we knew so much about it in those days, but it's highly polarized, highly selectively polarized.
You're talking about radio bursts?
Radio bursts, I suppose, or it might have been radio noise storms. You know, the people who were doing the theorizing weren't very close to the observations. Now, Ryle had shown a little bit before this that the ordinary idea that it might be gyro radiation fell down because there would be a region above where the gyro emission was generated which wouldn't propagate, and so it just couldn't get out.
Mm-hmm.
And Hoyle's idea was that if the things were going fast enough, it would be Doppler shifted, and so the relevant frequencies would be different and I'd be able to get through this region. And so that's what he set me to try and show.
I see.
I never did show. I still don't know the answer. I concluded at the time that the resonance of the electrons themselves was enough to kill it. The ones that were doing the radiating, and the Doppler shift business didn't work.
More or less self-absorption, you mean?
Well, self-reflection. So if it's not what the thing absorbs, it becomes non-propagating, reflecting.
But now, was this ever published?
No, it was never published. That was my PhD thesis, or the major part of it. But it didn't seem worth publishing. It was an awfully messy business with no clear result, which I believed.
And now, what period were you at Cambridge?
From September 49 to 52.
Okay, yes. And this obviously was a very critical time in terms of the nature of radio sources and so forth.
Yes.
How did you view the scene at that time?
Well, remember that when I went there, I didn't know much radio astronomy at all. I'd had very little contact with CSIRO before I went. They awarded a scholarship on the basis that I went and came back and worked for them, but I hadn't worked for them before. And since I, you know, wasn't terribly interested in astronomy, I hadn't really taken much interest in radio astronomy. Mm-hmm. I learnt quite a bit while I was in Cambridge, and I read a lot of papers, particularly the ones about mechanisms of origin. There were lots of fights went on between the radio astronomy group led by Ryle and the theoreticians, Bondi, Gould and Hoyle, who were really making a noise in Cambridge at that stage. I mean, they had all sorts of new ideas and they were shaking up astronomy with their wild ideas. The steady state,
right, that was number one.
Theory of the cosmology was, you know, at its peak.
But was this upsetting to the Ryle's group at this early stage, or was it only after 2C that this became a bone of contention?
I don't think it was having much effect on them because they thought that the sources were local at that stage.
So it was a moot point. But
yeah. As I was telling you before, the way I saw it was that Ryle's group had shown that the, what we now call radio sources, I suppose, or extragalactic radio sources or something, which were then called radio stars, were pretty uniformly distributed on the sky, and this suggested either that they were quite close or a very long way away. I mean, the structure of the galaxy wasn't showing up in the distribution. And some of the three, Bondi, Gold and Hoyle, were very strong for the extra black origin. I think Tommy Gold's the one I remember is talking about this. And while I was there, it must have been, I guess, in the last year I was there or something like that, Cygnus was identified.
It was late 51.
Yeah. Yes. And, I mean, Tommy Gold was cock-a-whoops about this because it showed that the second strongest radio source in the sky was a very, very long way away. Now, reading this thing of Edge and who was it?
Mulcahy.
Mulcahy. I got the impression that he thought that the world or Cambridge or somebody didn't accept this for many years after this, whereas my impression of the history was that almost immediately people said, okay, the wrong way away, and sort of accepted that.
Of course, it was very uncomfortable in terms of the luminosities that were implied, but it was equally uncomfortable to think about these weird type of stars that you had to postulate, I suppose.
Yeah, I think people didn't know how so much of the radiation was generated. I mean, you recall recent arguments about whether quasars are very distant. You know, one of the arguments is you can't account for the energy. Well, so what?
That's an interesting remark. So you're saying that as a theorist who concerns himself with these mechanisms, that argument doesn't buy anything for you because...
Oh, no, don't call me a theorist.
Okay.
I set out to be a theorist. I proved myself a failure. And ever since I've tried to be an observationalist.
As an interpreter, I've heard these three categories, observers, interpreters, and theorists. Will you be called an interpreter?
No, you can call me what you like.
Okay, but in any case, you don't put...
No,
well,
I mean, at that time,
that sort of
apart from the thermal radiation from the sun, I don't think anybody knew how any of the radiation...
I think that's right.
I mean, they
the
had...
The galactic background was certainly a mystery.
Well, there was the free emission. I mean, the Greenstein and Henning theory was during the war sometime.
Right, but it didn't...
It didn't work for a lot of it, but I think that probably was still assumed that some of it was generated in that way. I'm not sure.
Well, there were arguments, yeah.
I mean, one of the things that Fred Hoyle had me do when I first got there was concerned with the Crab Nebula, where... now, I'll probably get the story wrong, but... Yes, I think the angular size had just been measured and shown that the brightness temperature was...
Right. Smith measured the angular size of a few arguments.
And Bernie Mills did it about the same time. And I think this showed that the brightness temperature was so high that it couldn't be 10 to the 4th degree electrons. But Freud said, but you know, it could be much higher than that. It could be 10 to the 5th, it could be 10 to the 6th. Go try. Free emission.
Still thermal, right?
Because it turns out that jacking the temperature makes it worse because the optical depth gets less more rapidly than the temperature goes up, and you actually end up with less radiation. So that didn't work.
Well, this is slightly unrelated, but while we're on this topic, Shlosky's suggestion came out in 1953 in the original Russian version.
By which time I was back in Sydney.
Right, but I'm just wondering, while I think of it, how you took to that when you first heard about that.
Oh, the way I took to that was, I said, right, we should be able to detect the polarization of the optical radiation, which Shklovsky did not say.
That's right.
Despite the way it's quoted in the...
No, you're quite correct. That's a common misconception.
And I actually put this up at a conference in Canberra. I can't remember what it was, but it was... You know, I said, we ought to go look for this, but nobody took notice, and then Dombrowski came along and found it. So.
Right.
But you remind me of the history, because Alpha and Helifson was before that, wasn't
that's
it?
That's right, well, that's 51, yes.
Yeah.
Or
50, I mean, the idea of synchrotron was not new. It had been put up by Alpha and Helifson and several other people for the general galactic background.
Well, I forget which way it goes now. There was two papers, one by Alpha and Helifson on on Radio Stars or the background, I forget which way I went, the other on by Kiepenhauer.
Kiepenhauer, that's right.
And on the other one, I forget which did Radio Stars and which suggested the galactic background.
Yeah.
But despite these very early suggestions, I get the impression that even after 53, when Shklovsky's paper came out in Russian, that this was not generally accepted as the mechanism for anything. That it really wasn't until 55 or 6 that people began to...
I don't know, but once the linear polarization of the optical polarization from the crab was measured, I think that must
But that was for at least 4 years after these papers by Alfheim and Herleson at some
point. Oh, yes, after eyes. I don't think at the time of Alfheim and Herleson it was accepted. You were asking if I had any bits of paper. One thing which might help the history is I have a notebook somewhere on what I used to write down, abstract papers that I read, and might be interesting
to look at
that and see. Because I do remember reading all those papers, you know,
right,
and trying to understand the synchrotron theory they were all talking about.
That would be very interesting indeed.
See, as a matter of fact, part of my thesis was to show that if you had slightly rubber-based electrons, you ought to see the lower harmonics of the cyclotron frequency.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I wrote back to Paul Wilde and said, you know, how about this new machine you've got down at Dapto, can you see it? And of course, the first thing they did is find harmonics and say it wasn't cyclotron radiation. They said it was plasma radiation.
All right, before we get you back to Australia, are there any other remarks about how things were proceeding at Cambridge? From the point of view of someone in Hoyle's camp, anyway?
I don't think of anything at the moment.
Did you go to these RAS meetings?
No, I don't think I've ever been to an RAS meeting.
I see.
There were colloquia at Cambridge, of course, and they had this marvellous thing on Saturday mornings when a literature thing where people talked about the articles appearing in journals.
Right, I've heard about those, and this was designed mainly for the radio group, was it not?
Yes, that was run by Radcliffe, and people were assigned a certain number of journals to keep an eye on, and then each week some of these articles would be picked out and someone would be asked to talk about them the following week or something like that.
But people like you from Hoyle's camp?
No, I was invited along, but I wasn't given journals to read.
Oh, I see. So you were observing more or less.
Yeah, yeah.
And these were not just on radio astronomy then, I guess they were on atmospheric physics also.
Yes, you see, there was a strong group doing sort of plasma physics, propagation in non-uniform medium. Button and Clemo were both there. I don't know that I, you know, the other things I remember are sort of arguing with people in the in the group about various things.
Well, but that could be of interest if you can tell me what you were arguing about.
I wouldn't know now. I'd be arguing one way about a theory, say, with Martin Lyle, and I can remember Graham Smith was always trying to mediate it. Say, oh, well, you know, Martin, you might have a point there, or something like that.
Well, okay, now this is interesting. So even though you were a student of Hoyle's, you were over talking with Ryle about these things. And,
oh, yes. I wasn't part of the radio group in any sense, and I was never one of them.
Right, but you were talking with them. It's not the idea of two separate camps that never...
I mean, I saw them
volleys at each other.
You see... Hoyle's supervision really consisted of seeing me fairly rarely when I reckoned I'd got problems.
Mm-hmm.
We'd go and sit in some comfortable chairs down in the staff club and discuss these things. But, I actually had more day-to-day contact with some of the people in the radio group. I mean, some of the students in the radio group.
I see. So who else did you regularly contact with in that group?
Oh, there was a fellow called Hedding, who I think worked for Clemo. Who was not in the radio astronomy group. There was a girl who was married to
someone in the maths faculty. Forget her name now.
Which group was she in?
She was probably also in the ionosphere group, I think, doing theory of propagation or something like that. See, radio astronomy group, I guess, didn't contain any pure theorists. The pure theorists were probably all in the ionosphere group. And so since I was trying to be a theorist, I probably had more contact with them.
Yeah, I guess that's right. They probably, Martin Roth put out more theory than anyone else in the radio group at that time.
That's right. Mm, that's probably true.
Well, let's bring you back to Australia, and in particular this article that you wrote in 54, a review article for Research magazine, is interesting because, tell me how you came to write that review article, first of all.
Well, when I came back to Australia and joined CSIRO for the first time, which would be in, I suppose, November 52 or somewhere there, one of the things going on in the lab was what's now called cloud physics. And Taffy Bowen, who's the chief, was very interested in this. This was a project he'd started. And he wanted someone to work on the theory of the way raindrops coalesce.
Mm-hmm.
So he asked me if I'd have a go. So I had a go for 6 months, and I couldn't make any headway at all. So I simply gave up, and at that stage, I was put with Paul Wild in the Solar Radio Astronomy Group, working down at DAPTO. Well, they were great times. We used to go down to DAPTO about 3 days a week and got great memories of sitting out having morning tea in the sunshine, you know, and it'd go on for hours discussing all the fundamentals of astronomy or how the solid bursts were generated and this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I learned a tremendous amount from Paul just about radio and radio engineering and things like that that, you know, I didn't know about.
Were you actively aiding in the observations?
Yes, it was actually sunspot minimum. They'd built the DAPTO field station, and they'd got, well, we ran the thing every day on the sun, but there was very little activity. But there had been some very important activity in that the first harmonic type 2 burst had been recorded. This was before I came back. You see, the original solar observations were spectrum observations were at Penrith, and they didn't have a wide enough bandwidth to see harmonics.
Mm-hmm.
But DAPTO gave them, they had three bands and they had enough bands to see harmonics, and they recorded these harmonics. The other thing was that they'd recognised what are now called type 3 bursts, or were called type 3 bursts, I guess, by Paul from the Penrith observations. And I think in the literature there was the sort of suggestion that, you know, if they originated as plasma radiation, then they'd have to move at speeds of the order of C. But it was sort of in these discussions over morning tea, I remember Paul saying, you know, I wonder if they really do move at speed of order of C. And out of that came the paper, Wild Murray Row, in which they, you know, really said, let's say they are.
This was in Nature in 54.
About there, Wild right. Murray Row, I think it was.
Right, and you talk about the low frequency cutoff, and it's changing with time, implying a velocity of like 100,000 kilometers per second.
Right. Mm-hmm.
At this time, is it fair to say that really there was no competition in this solar burst field that had the equipment that could identify these kind of bursts and so forth?
I think that's right. I mean, these were the first spectrographs, and right. You really did have to feel it yourself.
But am I right also in saying that, I'm trying to get an idea of what your role was in the group. Were you out there tinkering with equipment and helping observing it?
I did a little bit towards helping with the observing. The other thing that was going on, because it was sunspot minimum, because there weren't many bursts, Paul had this idea of observing the scintillations produced in the ionosphere
observing the spectrum, mm-hmm. the dynamic spectrum. And so he built some larger aerials to look at Cygnus. And these were fixed aerials. And there was an interferometer.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition, to watch the drift of these patterns across the ground, he wanted a distant station. And at the time that I arrived on the scene, he'd only concluded from... He had three stations on the... at the field station Dapper, three aerials. And he'd seen the movements here, but they were so close together he couldn't tell just how big the things were. But I think at that stage he must have got the impression that they were elongated north-south. And so they built a... In fact, come to think of it, yes, they had a school at this stage in the lab where people were taught techniques. I mean, it was something they tried out. And I remember I did this school, and one of the jobs I had to do was to make this small Yagi aerial.
I see. Who organized this school?
Oh, the various more senior members of the group.
And they taught, like, gave lectures on different topics, you mean?
Yes, I think I can remember John Murray talking about building IF amplifiers, and I don't know, the Pawsey or somebody must have talked about aerials. Anyway, on the basis of this, I designed this aerial that we use for these Cygnus things. It was a small thing that went on a caravan, you see.
And I've never heard about this school. There weren't any notes published.
Oh, no, it's just one of these small things that went on for a few months, I think. You know, sort of thing happens all the time. There are no outsiders at all. It was just to help more junior people get some information, I think.
And what did you find out from these Cygnus A observations?
Well, I've got to tell you the important thing. The important thing was that it had been specially arranged that these observations would be made when the tests were on in England, the cricket tests, so that one could sit out in this caravan in the middle of the night and record these damn things and listen to the cricket test. Now, I got no interest in cricket at all.
Paul Wells did.
Paul and his cronies did. So it fell to me to be out in this caravan and listen to the cricket test.
This was an excuse to be up in the middle of the night, you mean?
Well, something to do while you had to be up in the middle of the night to record the things. Oh, what came out of it? It was very interesting. On the basis of the spectrum, which was recorded adapter, of course, Paul became absolutely convinced that it was a focusing thing, that each peak was due to one irregularity in the ionosphere acting like a lens.
I see.
And this is all published.
Right, I have the papers here.
But not much notice has been taken of it. Warwick and Singleton at Boulder later on did similar observations, came to exactly the same conclusion. And a few years back, Basil Briggs, who used to be at Cambridge, has been at Adelaide for some years, writing some review, and he was talking to me and wanted to use one of our figures. He said, "You know, I think that paper's been neglected." And I said, "Yeah, people still don't accept, I think, the fact that they are focusing irregularities in that case."
Well, of course, my main interest is in radio astronomy, but I'd like to ask you, it appears that at that time that someone like Paul Wilde was willing to do the ionosphere as well as the cosmos, just whatever was handy to do with. In other words, it was just radio physics. He didn't really care whether he was looking at the sun or the ionosphere.
I mean, Paul Wilde's a physicist, and Joe Pawsey was a physicist but trained in the ionosphere. And so, I mean, he had a lot of people around the lab who had come from the ionosphere and knew that and were obviously interested in continuing. I mean, you know, Pawsey did quite a lot of work on the ionosphere.
But even after these really exciting results on the different kind of solar bursts and so forth, he didn't... you said it was solar minimum, but nevertheless you still...
It was solar minimum, and it was just at the time that... Let's face it, the way Cygnus was discovered was because of scintillations.
Right.
There was a lot of interest in scintillations. The space receiver observations had been done in England and had been shown there were, in fact, ionospheric scintillations. And some funny things had been found about them, like day-to-night variations and things. And I guess, you know, it was just a topic that was of interest.
Did it affect the radio astronomical observations so that you wanted to understand these better too?
A lot of solar observations since I've shown effects which are due to the ionosphere and which you can recognize because you've studied scintillations of radio.
So was that part of the motivation at that time?
I don't think so. I wouldn't have thought so. We were just interested in the scintillations.
Well, tell me about this review article.
Well, about all I can remember about it is that Pawsey had been asked to write this review, that he presumably thought it would do me good to read the literature, and so he asked me if I'd do it. And I obviously had to read a lot of literature. As I said, I think at that stage he could have read every article that had ever been published in radio astronomy, and I went fairly close to it. I obviously didn't read everything. I must have been strongly influenced by Paul Weil because I was working at ADAPT at the time, and I can well remember him telling me about the wartime reports by Hay and, and so on, which I presumably dug out copies out of our library and things like that. But my introduction to radio astronomy probably came more from Paul than anybody else.
And what would you say were your main conclusions as you surveyed the entire field at that time?
It's a bit hard to answer that from this distance. Presumably I tried to write them into that paper, and obviously that paper was read by Pawsey. And I don't know if you know anything about the way publications come out of this place, but they go through a pretty rugged routine before they get out.
Well, tell me about that, especially at that time.
Well, of course I can't really remember at that time, but I think there's always been a fair control on publications. And, well, I mean, certainly at that stage I knew so little that I certainly would have asked people about it anyway. In other words, I think there is some point in thinking of it as the views of perhaps Pawsey and Weil at that stage.
At least they certainly didn't disagree with anything in here. They might have done it a little bit differently, but
yeah, they might have done it differently, obviously. But
you were still calling the objects radio stars, as I mentioned to you at this stage, even though Cygnus A had been identified. In fact, you have a table here of possible and definite identifications, including 5128 and 1275 and the Crab, of course, and so forth.
Yes, I don't think this name... Well, you see, it's actually called Radio Source.
Well, in the table, it is, it is.
But that's the name true. Radio Star hung around for a long time.
I know. I was surprised to find out that Edge's thesis, which was the original 3C survey, was called a survey of radio stars. And this is 59.
Yes. Yes.
So,
I don't...
I shouldn't read anything into that except it's just a name that...
No, it was just a name. They were known as radio stars and, you know, people were presumably saying this is a silly word. There's a thing that people around here laugh about by Ron Bracewell in Observatory called Radio Stars or Radio Nebula.
Yes, I'm familiar with that.
No, I don't know what date that was.
54.
54.
Why do people laugh about it?
Oh, just because Ron wrote it. And he had nothing to do with the observations or anything.
I've heard it said by some that that paper is perhaps important, but an interesting one from the point of view that it was one of the first indeed to point out this business about different angular sizes. And,
can't remember now, you know, how it came to be written, but...
I haven't talked to him yet. But, so.
To Ron?
Right. So.
No, but you'd do well to talk to other people around here about that because, you know, I wasn't involved in the business, but I think people did laugh about it, saying it, almost as though, you know, he's saying the obvious, whereas you're looking at it in a different way. And
well, maybe it was common knowledge at that time, but it had never been put down in paper. Perhaps in the same way that we were talking about the Baikarian lecture by Ryle, which came along in 58 and in print, maybe the first time to make a solid case that all these sources are extragalactic.
Yes, yes.
And yet, everyone no one was surprised by the result.
Yes.
Okay, well, speaking of Bracewell, apparently you got hooked up with him in this, at least it was one paper, on aerial smoothing in 54. And once again, I haven't talked to Bracewell, so I haven't gotten from the horse's mouth, but this whole business is particularly fascinating to me about deconvolution and what you can do and what you can't do. What did you find in this first paper?
Well, let me tell you what happened there. I can remember while I was at Cambridge, Kevin Westphal came to Cambridge. Kevin did a doctorate at Oxford, I guess. And he had worked with John Bob.